The 1992 Los Angeles uprising, the Cambodian genocide, Japanese-American incarceration. What you know isn't always the full story. Our new podcast, Inheriting, about Asian American and Pacific Islander families where the past is personal.
Korean Americans, we call it sa-i-gu.
Did you ever realize when you were a child that you became an orphan?
Camp was such a hard time. How do you think you got through it?
Listen to Inheriting from LAS Studios and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. Voters in Iran are sitting out a presidential election in protest.
I do not accept the rules of this game.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, why Iranian voters are fed up. Plus, an international arrest warrant for the president of Syria is a reminder of the outrage over Assad. But increasingly, his leadership is being normalized.
What the Syrian conflict really shows is that if you have a great power patron, you could get protection for years of war crimes.
And new technology is helping visually impaired opera goers follow the plot. A handheld device gives real-time translations in Braille.
The first time that the Braille display moved automatically under my fingers, I squealed.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here today.
A lot of voters in Iran are expected to boycott tomorrow's election there, a vote to replace President Ibrahim Raisi, who died in a helicopter crash last month. Iran's Guardian Council selected six candidates for the ballot. Two have dropped out. And as the world's Duri Buscarin reports, apathy could take the lead.
There were times when 38-year-old freelance writer Shagayek believed in elections. Speaking over video chat and a shaky VPN connection, she's asked to only be identified by her first name for her safety.
I fully accepted to participate in an election and to vote under the suppressive rules of this rigid system.
Shagayek tells me through an interpreter that in 2009, she even campaigned for a moderate candidate. And she joined protesters in the streets when he claimed the election was stolen from him, after she was jailed for protesting and later even falsely accused of conspiring with the enemy. Shagayek began to boycott elections.
Not participating, I was trying to give the message that I do not accept the rules of this game.
This conviction only became stronger after the death in custody of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini almost 2 years ago. Amini was beaten by Iran's morality police for allegedly wearing her headscarf immodestly, sparking widespread protests. More than 500 protesters were killed in violent crackdowns on the movement, according to an independent fact-finding mission by the UN. Thousands were tortured in custody or left in solitary confinement, including Shagayek. And that is why 90% of Shagayek's friends and family will not vote, she says. They've tried to force the government to change, and now they're walking away.
Maybe only a few, that can be counted by fingers of one hand or something, that still have hope that there might be a chance that voting might change something.
Those voters who do have hope, she says, are planning to vote for reformist candidate Masoud Pezeshkian, a parliamentarian and former health minister. He's a member of the Azerbaijani ethnic minority, which represents about a fifth of Iranians. On Wednesday evening, Pezeshkian addressed thousands of supporters in his hometown of Tabriz. He spoke in Azerbaijani, a language that's more similar to Turkish than Persian. Sina Tusi, an Iran analyst at the Washington-based Center for International Policy, says online polls suggest that about half of Iranians will not vote on Friday.
Pezeshkian, his main hurdle is generating enthusiasm from the constituency that traditionally has voted for reformists in past elections, but has shunned the recent election since 2022.
Tusi says it's likely that Iran's Guardian Council permitted a reformist candidate to run with the hope that it would increase election turnout and make the vote appear more legitimate.
It does seem like in the past weeks, momentum has built. And as these videos show, there are pretty sizable crowds that are showing up to these Pezeshkian rallies.
Sanam Vakil, director of the Middle East North Africa program for Chatham House, disagrees that Pezeshkian could be a major disruptor.
I think that he's seen as someone who's loyal, perhaps pliable.
Conservative voters are split between Mohamed Bakir Ghalibaf, a traditionalist parliament speaker, and hardliner Saeed Jalili, a former chief nuclear negotiator close to the late president Ebrahim Raisi.
You know, the candidates remain very loyal to the Islamic Republic and the Supreme Leader, and they've demonstrated a commitment to working within the state apparatus. These are not disruptors.
What's more, Vakil says, presidential powers are limited in Iran. Foreign policy is directed by the Supreme National Security Council, where the president has a seat. Domestic policies are shaped by consensus with the cabinet and parliament.
He doesn't have independent influence, and all of the sort of policies and decision-making is very consensus-based and requires the supreme leader's sort of blessing.
And perhaps that gets to the heart of why many potential voters in Iran say they won't go to the polls. In a series of voice notes sent over Telegram, a 37-year-old engineer named Milad says that when people don't participate in an election, a campaign becomes cold and soulless. People are angry because they have no way to express their voice to the government except by protesting in the street, which also costs them too much, Milad says. Why would he vote and legitimize an election that he sees as a sham? Polls in Iran open tomorrow. If no candidate receives more than half the vote, the election will go to a runoff on July 5th. For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin, Istanbul.
Bolivia's capital, La Paz, saw intense political drama last night. The country's former army chief led armored vehicles to ram the doors of the government palace. What followed was several hours of confusion about who was actually in control of the government. But Bolivia's president, Luis Arce, stood firm, and a new army chief is in place now. To get a handle on the rift in Bolivia, we got in touch with Michael Parlberg, a professor of Latin American politics at Virginia Commonwealth University.
Well, there are many different rifts in Bolivian politics that predate this coup attempt. There have been divides between the left and the right, the western highlands versus the eastern lowlands, indigenous versus mestizo and white populations, and in recent years, especially between the pro and anti-Evo Morales constituencies in the country. So the general suggested in his inflammatory remarks, which got him dismissed, that he was protecting the country from another Evo Morales presidency.
You've mentioned Evo Morales a couple of times, former president of Bolivia. He's not in Bolivia. He's in exile, but he still has enormous influence in the country, apparently. Where is he exactly, and why does he retain such important stature in Bolivia?
Former President Evo Morales was president for 14 years. He was ousted in what he called a coup in 2019 and fled to Argentina. But he is largely responsible for President Arce becoming president after naming him as his chosen successor. He still has a very popular, strong base of support among mostly indigenous, especially among rural coca farmers, where he got his start as a coca farmer union leader. And so he still very much holds power. He has signaled his interest in running for president again. He's a polarizing figure, so this is not a popular decision with many Bolivians. Arce, on the other hand, is much more of a soft-spoken technocrat, and he has been relatively popular, although his popularity has been fading recently, but he's seen as having overseen a steady, though slow, economic recovery from the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, Bolivia is in the midst of a severe economic crisis now. Explain that, and is there any possible connection to General Zuniga's attempt to take charge?
Bolivia has been facing a number of challenges, most notably a shortage of dollars, and the government has responded by severely restricting the amount of dollars people can pull out of the banks. There has also been an energy crisis, and this is a great irony for a country that used to export a lot of natural gas. Now it has been reliant on imports. It has also had to go deeply into debt in order to finance a subsidy on gas purchases, and these subsidies are not really sustainable fiscally in the long run. And so while the president has been able to tout certain economic successes, such as keeping inflation relatively low, I think that it's harder for him to maintain his popularity in the face of these pressures.
It makes me wonder how this news was received by people in Bolivia. Would many of them have supported General Zuniga's attempt to grab power?
It seems from the protests outside of the presidency that many people were in favor of Arce holding on to power. The General Workers Union, a very strong factor in Bolivian politics for decades, mobilized support, called a general strike. There were many protesters who were calling on the army to step down. Now that is in La Paz, which is the seat of power of the government. Right. And in the eastern lowlands, for example, there is much less support for the government.
Michael, what are you looking for next in Bolivia?
The big story will be the 2025 elections, and it currently looks like it'll be a showdown between Arce and his former mentor and boss, Evo Morales. And this says something about the divisions in Bolivian politics. It's not exactly left-right. It's, in many ways, it's different flavors of the left. The ruling MAS party has been split. There's the Renewal and Pachamamista wing, which is a little bit more socially liberal. And then there's the Marxist developmentalist wing led by former President Morales and former Vice President García Linera, which is in favor of extractive industry development. And if a left-wing president is successful, which is quite likely, I think that one of these two factions will be dominant in the future.
Michael Parlberg teaches Latin American politics at Virginia Commonwealth University.
Operas are often performed in Italian, like this one, or German or French, with surtitles above the stage translating the lyrics. But that doesn't help people in the audience who are visually impaired. Now, an opera company in New Zealand offers a solution. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Paul Brown remembers one school field trip in particular from his childhood in Scotland.
As a 13-year-old blind boy, we were taken by our blind school to the opera to see The Marriage of Figaro, and I hated it.
It was in Italian, which didn't help. But more than that, there weren't sufficient tools for Brown and his fellow blind and low-vision classmates to understand what was going on.
No one told us the story beforehand. Just all this Figaro, Figaro, Figaro stuff, you know.
After that, he avoided the opera for a long time. In the years since, there have been major advancements in making live performances more accessible. One common option is audio descriptions, which Brown now produces for his company, Audio Described Aotearoa, in New Zealand.
Patrons wear an earpiece, and the audio describer describes the kind of visual elements of shows.
That can work well for many people, and it has allowed Brown to enjoy operas more than he did as a kid.
But it's not seamless. You know, you are listening to the opera and listening to something else.
Now there's a new option. Here's how it works. Audience members open up a web page on their phone where the surtitles pop up lyric by lyric. Each line is then sent to their personal braille display. That's a handheld device with small, round-tipped pins that pop up to produce different braille characters. As the surtitles change on the phone, the braille display also changes, automatically giving the braille reader the next lyric or line of dialogue. Brown was part of the testing team for the new technology.
The first time that the braille display moved automatically under my fingers when the line of singing changed, I squealed. You know, this is just so exciting.
The innovation, believed to be the first of its kind, is thanks to Brad Cohen. He's the general director of New Zealand Opera, the country's national opera company.
The technology really began as a lockdown project about how we might reimagine surtitles for opera in a way that was suited to the 21st century. And then the accessibility benefits of it became apparent over time.
It's now been successfully tested during the company's current run of Rossini's Le Comte Henri. Cohen says major opera houses like New York's Metropolitan Opera have already reached out with interest. He adds that it's not just opera that can benefit.
The applications are massive, I think. Sports scores, conference addresses, broadcast news, anything that begins with an existing script, even if it's a script created in the last 10 milliseconds, can be fed into our system and served. So yeah, I think it's a very adaptable technology.
Paul Brown acknowledges that some people who are blind or have low vision don't read Braille and would rather listen to audio descriptions instead of this new option.
What this does is give choice. And that just feels great that that's been thought about and that we are included in that way.
New Zealand Opera will now use the new technology in all of its future performances. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A court in Paris has upheld an international arrest warrant for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. France issued the warrant last year for Assad's alleged complicity in war crimes during Syria's civil war, including the use of chemical weapons against civilians. The war in Syria has taken a lot of turns since it started. Notably, Assad has emerged from pariah status to being largely accepted as the de facto ruler of Syria again. We asked Natasha Hall to help us understand how that happened. She's with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington and took us back to the protest movement that started Syria's civil war in 2011.
It's hard to believe now, but many people didn't really see it coming yet in Syria. It started as some brief protests from typical political opponents within cities like Damascus, but it quickly rippled outward into the countryside. And it was really the regime's reaction to those initial protests and calls for reform that made it spiral outward into a larger, more violent conflict that we see today.
Yeah, I mean, is that basically the reason why things became so terribly violent then in 2012?
Yeah, essentially what happened is the regime doubled down on, you know, not just young men, but also children, women, arrested, detained, and tortured hundreds, if not thousands, in those early days, shot on protesters. And so it really made a sort of a larger movement that expanded throughout the country and really went across socioeconomic divides as well.
Yeah, and around this time, as things were escalating, the Obama administration said using chemical weapons was a red line that should not be crossed in the conflict by the Assad regime. Despite that, by most intelligence accounts, it happened anyway in August of 2013. Tell us about that.
So in August 2013, and this is one of the reasons that there is an arrest warrant for Bashar al-Assad today in France, is that an estimated 1,400 people were killed in a sarin gas attack in eastern Ghouta in Syria. This was after President Obama had issued a red line saying that chemical weapons usage would be essentially a reason for him to rethink his strategy on Syria. In other words, perhaps an offensive strategy against Syria's regime. That did not happen. Russia came in to save the day, Russia being eventually Bashar al-Assad's stalwart military ally, and essentially said that Syria would hand over its chemical weapons, sign up to the Chemical Weapons Convention. And so the U.S. sort of withdrew that threat. But unfortunately, what ended up happening is that over the course of the next 10 years, Bashar al-Assad actually did continue to use chemical weapons in the form of chlorine gas, at least 350 times that we know of, and sarin gas at least one other time as well.
So by 2014, it's become a protracted conflict. Remind us of the extremist groups that then stepped into the power vacuum.
So it wasn't at all surprising that such a thing would happen. In fact, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad had been known for releasing al-Qaeda members actually from prisons in order to draw up chaos in Iraq and neighboring Iraq in the years prior. The same thing happened in this situation, but also extremists from other countries came into Syria and formed groups that were essentially al-Qaeda offshoots like the Nusra Front. And they essentially became more powerful than the sort of the traditional opposition forces in the country.
Yeah, and obviously big concern with ISIS there for the United States and then the 2014 U.S. intervention to remove ISIS from power. I'm wondering what that did to move some attention away from Assad's crimes and actions and start his slow reputational rehabilitation.
It did quite a lot. And I think it did so beyond, you know, Russia or China or the rest of the world. I think even within the United States, there is a boiling down of the complexity of the Syrian conflict to one that essentially makes it a choice between Assad or ISIS. The reality, of course, is that Bashar al-Assad killed far more Syrian civilians than ISIS did throughout its reign, which extended until 2019, and there are still cells within the country. But certainly, I think it shifted the narrative on the Syrian conflict to the benefit of Bashar al-Assad and to the Kremlin.
Yeah, you mentioned the direct and proxy interventions by Russia and by Iran to shore up Assad's forces. How has that affected the outcome in Syria and given Assad more legitimacy?
Oh, well, without a doubt, for military reasons, it saved the Assad regime. Iran came in very early on to help reinforce Syrian forces, which had largely been weakened because of mass defections within the Syrian army. And later on, the Russian regime also came in 2015 with significant air power in the forms of fighter jets that really just annihilated certain communities. And so that really turned the tide for the Assad regime, which had been flailing up and until 2015, I would say. On the diplomatic side, I think what the Syrian conflict really shows is that if you have a great power patron, if you have a patron on the Security Council in particular, you could get protection for years of war crimes.
That would be Russia?
And that would be Russia in this case, not always Russia, but in this case, certainly Russia, and essentially be able to shift your status over time from pariah to acceptable state player.
Yeah, and by 2018, Assad and his allies start to reclaim a lot of the territory that was previously lost to the armed opposition and other groups. At that point, Natasha, did everyone realize that Assad, this international pariah with war crimes charges hanging over his head, that he wasn't going anywhere?
For a lot of us that had been watching after Assad crossed the red line and there was little accountability for that, we already sort of knew that Assad may, in fact, win. And that was reinforced by Russia's intervention in 2015. As of now, Assad has retained about 65% of territory, most of the major cities in Syria. And so many have basically resigned themselves to Assad being victorious. The problem, of course, is the remaining 35% and the fact that half of the country has been displaced, and reconstruction will probably cost in upwards of $250 billion. So I think a lot of people have resigned themselves to this simply because there's seemingly no other options to really effectively deal with Bashar al-Assad in a way that sort of reduces impunity within Syria, but I think also at the global level.
In recent years, we've also started to see neighboring Arab states normalize relations with the Assad regime. What's that about?
So I think that they're also sort of dealing with the reality here that it is Russia and Iran that have become the more committed players in this conflict, and therefore Assad has survived. And if Assad survives, then I think many players, including oil-rich Gulf states like the UAE and Saudi Arabia, want to play ball with this particular actor on the ground in a way to diminish Iranian influence, but also to increase their own influence within the region.
Do you think the U.S. and Europe might eventually see past what unfolded in Syria and decide to also normalize with this regime on some level?
I think the reality is a bit more ambiguous than that for the United States and Europe, and unfortunately to the detriment of Syrian civilians, because what you see today is essentially a policy of humanitarian aid and sanctions, and with really no diplomatic path forward or even military path forward. And so the result of that is essentially a festering wound that will predictably rise and fall with violence, chaos, and outward migration for the foreseeable future.
Ultimately, Natasha, do you understand the conflict in Syria to be over and Assad to be the victor, or is it more of a low-simmering conflict that's just ongoing?
Well, it's certainly not over. And unfortunately, today, Syria resembles a lot of conflicts around the world, which are all lasting on average about 30 years. We have more conflicts today than we've had since World War II. And so I believe it will be a low sort of festering conflict that will be exploited by other actors for many, many years to come.
Natasha Hall is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. More global news and stories are still ahead for you this hour. You're listening to The World.
A scientist spotted a group of painted lady butterflies on a beach in French Guiana.
Actually, I was very surprised because these butterflies do not occur in South America.
Turns out they'd flown 2,600 miles nonstop. Plus,
España!
Spain's youngest soccer star ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Britain is heading for change. That's the promise of Keir Starmer, the man expected to become the next UK Prime Minister. Starmer leads the centre-left Labour Party, and he's polling more than 20 points ahead of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and his Conservative Party. National elections are just a week away, but as The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports, for many British voters, Starmer remains an enigma.
There's one question Keir Starmer gets asked a lot.
Are you too boring to be the next Prime Minister?
You seem more like a political robot.
You have in the past, and I apologise for saying so, been called boring.
Starmer doesn't take offence. After the turbulent years of Boris Johnson, followed by two more Conservative Prime Ministers in just 22 months, he knows that being boring isn't much of an insult.
I'm running as a candidate to be Prime Minister, not a candidate to run the circus.
Starmer, who's 61, is late to political life. He was first elected to Parliament at the age of 52. But he's been in the public eye for much longer. He was Director of Public Prosecutions in Britain for 5 years and received a knighthood for his services in 2014. In the UK, he's known as Sir Keir Starmer. But his roots are a long way away from royal titles.
We couldn't make ends meet. We couldn't pay our bills.
He says he knows what it feels like to be anxious about the next bill. Starmer's mother was a nurse, and his father, well, his job is something Starmer likes to bring up in interviews.
He was a toolmaker. He was a skilled man.
My dad, he was a toolmaker.
My dad was a toolmaker. My dad was a toolmaker.
So much so, in fact, that TV audiences have started to make fun of it.
Except I earn a lot of money in the job I am now in, but when I grew up, my dad was a toolmaker. He worked in a factory. It's true.
Starmer is promising to deliver economic stability, improve the national healthcare system, and scrap a controversial plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. But some say figuring out what Starmer really stands for isn't that easy.
I think the public are still very much confused about what Keir Starmer is and what Starmerism means.
Matthew Flinders is a politics professor at the University of Sheffield. He says that sense of confusion might actually be working in the Labour leader's favour.
In a sense, it allows him to build up a very broad audience. Without saying exactly what you are, means that you don't trigger a lot of potential enemies.
One thing his enemies can't deny, though, is that Starmer has successfully dragged the Labour Party back from near oblivion in just a few years.
He's turned the Labour Party around from a party that were absolutely devastated after the 2019 defeat to pull that back and be 20 points ahead in the polls.
It's a remarkable feat, Alice Perry, a campaigner for the Labour Party in London, tells me. Some critics say the party is now too centrist and that Starmer has been ruthless towards more left-wing Labour candidates. Perry doesn't disagree.
Keir Starmer is ruthless, and that is a positive quality, because if he hadn't been ruthless, he wouldn't have been able to reform the Labour Party in the way that was necessary.
Starmer's response to the Israeli assault on Gaza following the Hamas attack in October has also divided Labour Party members. In late October, he gave a radio interview defending Israel's actions.
I'm very clear. Israel must have that, does have that right to defend herself, and Hamas bears responsibility.
A siege is appropriate? Cutting off power, cutting off water, Sakir?
Well, I think that Israel does have that right. It is an ongoing situation.
His comments drew huge criticism from some supporters. The party has a large following among Britain's Muslim population.
I imagine I've been supporting the Labour Party for at least 15 years, if not more, because Labour, for me, were always the party of social justice.
Khalid Anis, a dentist in Manchester, tells me he wasn't just a Labour supporter, but also a card-carrying member of the party. A few months ago, he says, he resigned that membership.
Because of Keir Starmer's and the leadership's reaction to what was happening in Palestine, it was unacceptable.
In February, the Labour Party called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. Anis says that was too little too late. He's not sure how he'll vote in next week's election, he says. Last night, Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak faced each other off in a testy TV debate. The question that got the biggest round of applause of the night came from Robert Blackstock, a member of the audience.
Are you two
really the best we've got to be the next Prime Minister of our great country.
The British public will make its choice at the polling booth on July 4th. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Butterflies are delicate, but they're also tough. And this week, we're understanding a bit more about how tough they can be. We've long known that monarch butterflies are champion flyers. They migrate every year from North America to central Mexico. Their journey is multi-generational, so the butterflies that start the trip aren't the ones that complete it. But new research indicates that another butterfly, the Painted Lady, can travel across the entire Atlantic Ocean in one go without stopping. Entomologist Gerard Talavera's research into the remarkable migration began when he stumbled across a group of painted ladies on a beach in French Guiana in 2013.
One morning, early in the morning, I could see a group of butterflies standing on the sand, pretty exhausted. They barely could move. Actually, I was very surprised because these butterflies do not occur in South America. So they had to be migrants in some way.
What did you see on the beach that showed you that these butterflies were exhausted? How did they look?
They were really standing with the open wings in the sand. That's a very strange place for a butterfly to stand. You never see butterflies, or very rarely, standing on the sand of a beach. They usually stop in the vegetation. They hide at night, or they go to flowers to feed. But they were really standing there like the first piece of land that they could see. Right? They barely could fly. So when I step close, the butterflies usually fly and leave. These ones didn't fly. They just jump a little bit trying to escape. But I felt they had no energy to do much more than that.
You surmised that these butterflies had made a transatlantic journey with no pit stops. It took you some detective work to test this theory out, though. How did you do it?
We had to develop some techniques. For example, we use genomics, population genetics studies, that allowed us to identify that these butterflies had more genetic similarity to populations that occur in Europe and in Africa, more than those that occur in North America.
You also, I gather, tested the pollen that was clinging to these butterflies, and that gave you some evidence as well.
Exactly. That was the next step. And we actually could isolate pollen grains that these butterflies were carrying in their bodies. And we sequenced their DNA. That allowed us to identify what were the plants that this pollen belongs to. And we identify plants that are endemic or typical from tropical Africa. So that was proof of a transoceanic crossing. And one of the methods that I didn't mention was isotope geolocation, which was the last of them that we incorporated in our analysis, which were critical to understand where these butterflies were actually raised. Where did they born? And we learned that these butterflies didn't probably grow in West Africa, but they came farther from the north. So they probably were born in countries of Western Europe. So making this trip even longer than the transoceanic crossing, up to 7,000 kilometers, we estimate.
Nearly 4,500 miles. It's extraordinary. I think of butterflies, and especially their wings, as so delicate and potentially easily damaged during a rough transatlantic journey. How did they do it?
We need to clarify that we're talking about a species that is adapted to migrate. They have a physiological capacity that, as we prove here, can be really extraordinary. But one of the elements that were critical in this transoceanic crossing was they were aided by the winds, and we estimate that without the winds, they couldn't have completed the crossing. Just flying by themselves, they could just complete it a piece of this crossing until they actually run out of energy or fat content transforming to energy. So the wind, the easterly winds actually that blow constantly from Africa towards America, really helped them to complete this journey.
So they had to have the winds at their back, basically, for this to happen.
They use the wings to make an active flight, not to fall into the sea, and probably use also the winds to climb up a little bit on altitude for those ascendant winds, and just to rest while the winds are favorable.
Gerard, I gather you saw about 10 butterflies on this beach that morning in French Guiana. Do you think that they were blown off course and they weren't intending to be there? Or is this evidence of a, intentional larger migration?
It is very likely that what happened here is that some of these specimens were accidentally blown into the ocean. And once they were in the ocean, they were just following the winds until they arrived to South America.
And how long did that journey take, do you estimate?
Between 5 and 8 days.
And is this, as far as you know, the first transoceanic journey ever recorded by an insect?
So we have seen other insects that actually cross the Atlantic Ocean. One specimen here, one specimen there. There have been migratory locusts observed in the Caribbean, for example.
Migratory locusts?
Yes, and some dragonflies that suddenly appeared in Western Europe. But this is the first time that we can actually find empirical evidence and prove it.
Entomologist Gerard Talavera works at the Botanical Institute of Barcelona in Spain. He and colleagues have written about the transatlantic journey of the Painted Lady Butterfly in this week's issue of Nature Communications.
And now a few things in the news that you might have missed.
Researchers say Canada's catastrophic wildfires last year put more than 3 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the air. The fires blazed for months and were large enough to cause global air quality problems. Today, the World Resources Institute released data showing climate change played a role in those fires, which in turn contributed to even more warming by spewing carbon into the atmosphere.
France is hosting, of course, the Olympics next month, but France was also front and center at last night's NBA draft. 4 French players were picked in round 1, confirming France's strength in the game. Names to look for on jerseys next season: Zachary Risacher, Alex Sarr, Tijan Salon, and Pacome Dadier.
Julian Assange hasn't commented publicly since arriving home in Australia, but his wife Stella Assange thanked Australian lawmakers today for campaigning on his behalf. Julian Assange pleaded guilty this week to a single charge under the U.S. Espionage Act. Australians are crediting Prime Minister Anthony Albanese with the diplomatic coup that enabled Assange to be released from a London prison.
And that is a few things you might have missed. Now to a story about a soccer player breaking all kinds of records in Europe, records for skill and for his age. FC Barcelona striker Lamine Yamal is just 16. He's been a standout all year, and right now he's playing for Spain's national team at the Euro Cup in Germany. Yamal grew up in Mataró, about an hour north of Barcelona, so that's where the world's Jerry Haddon went to get his story.
Call him Lamine the Youngest.
Yamal clips that one over the top. Dembele can finish this one.
At 15 years and 290 days old, he became the youngest player to debut with football club Barcelona, known simply as Barça. At 16 and 57 days, he was the youngest to start and score for Spain's national team. And this month, he became the youngest player to play in the Euro Cup tournament. Where he delivered a decisive assist in Spain's 3-0 win over Croatia. Yamal was born in Spain to a Moroccan dad and a mom from Equatorial Guinea in West Africa. He grew up in a working-class, mostly immigrant neighborhood here in Mataró called Rocafonda. Lamine left Rocafonda 5 years ago to live and study at Barça's boarding school for upcoming talent, La Masia. But people here have not forgotten him. Just before the Spain-Italy match, 3 teens stop on the street to describe the kid they used to play pickup soccer with in the park. Anas Abdelkale, Nassim Beril, and Alam Bentas all agree that Yamal is a great guy, a modest kid respected throughout the neighborhood. They say he gives Rocafonda a good name. And they say he doesn't forget. After each goal Yamal scores, he flashes the numbers 304 with his fingers. That's the last part of Rocafonda's zip code. And the team comes back to visit when he can, although with fame, that's gotten complicated. In an interview this month with Spanish TV, Yamal talked about the normal things he used to do in Rocafonda, like picking up his little brother from school. "Is that hard with all the attention you now get?" asks a reporter. Yamal smiles. In winter, he says, "I pull up my hood so people can't recognize me. In warmer weather, I grin and bear it." Rocafonda is a neighborhood of aging apartment buildings where residents, mostly immigrants, struggle to get by. Locals say poverty, a lack of services, and crime make life here difficult. When I arrive, I ask around for the best bar to watch Yamal play. Over and over, I'm advised to catch the game somewhere else.
Silvan, sube la persiana, tiran el paquete, se van.
One local resident, who will only give her first name, Alba, tells me to leave before dark. Rocafonda is rampant with drug dealing, she says. All night long, they're dropping drugs from windows down to the street. And the police won't come if you call them, she says, because they'll be attacked.
Pelea.
Cada noche.
A couple of elderly women outside a nearby cafe describe nearly daily fights on the streets. They don't want to give their names. And the game, I ask? These days, they say, people watch soccer at home. But I do find one bar with the match on. It's called La Esperanza, or The Hope in English.
And the game's begun.
But there's hardly a frenzied crowd of Yamal fans inside, cheering on their hometown hero. Counting the bartender, there are five of us. At the bar drinking is Nicolás Lozano, a veteran journalist and retired TV soccer commentator, originally from Bogotá, Colombia.
Desparpajo, ¿no? Tiene esas cualidades innatas.
Yamal's got nerve, he says, and self-confidence. He's going to be the next Messi, he says, referring to former Barca legend Lionel Messi, the master ball handler and goal scorer who also came to the club as a kid from Argentina. Yamal as the second coming of Messi. You hear that a lot, actually. He's that good if you haven't seen him with the ball. If you have, it's easy to forget his age. But he is still just 16. In this interview on Spanish TV, he's sitting at his desk in his room at La Masia, books open, cramming for a 10th grade English test. I just want to sleep, he complains, like any teenager. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Mataró, Spain.
Turns out Germany is also worried about Yamal's sleep. Under German law, minors are not allowed to work past 11 p.m. Yamal has done so three times so far while playing in the Euro Cup in Berlin. The fine for the Spanish team, if applied, about $33,000 per infraction. No doubt a price it would pay to keep their star teen playing.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek is walking 24,000 miles from the Horn of Africa across Asia to the southern tip of South America. It's the same path our human ancestors took as they first settled the globe. During his trek, Salopek has been writing about the people, history, and land on the route.
We're standing in a fortress along the Silk Road called Ganesh, which is more than 1,000 years old. And which controlled the major artery of trade north-south between Western China, going all the way down to India.
That's Salopek in a video from northern Pakistan in 2017, and it's the part of his journey we'll be talking with him about today. Hey, Paul, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Carolyn, great to be here again.
So, Paul, I want to ask you about that specific village that you mentioned in that video in a moment, but first, talk to me about the route that you took across this very mountainous region of northern Pakistan. The peaks are stunning. They look totally impassable. How did you decide where to walk?
Yeah, well, I had no choice. I was coming down through Afghanistan, and there was only one way to get over into India, which was through this truly, truly extraordinary corner of the world, northern Pakistan, called Gilgit-Baltistan. And it's, imagine Nepal, but very few people from the outside know about it. It has the highest concentration of 25,000-foot mountains anywhere in the world, including K2. Low valleys, and it was the only kind of bottleneck for me to squeeze through. I came down over a 16,000-foot mountain pass from Afghanistan in order to reach the capital, Islamabad.
So this area is in northern Pakistan near the border with China, and you write in your dispatches that it's held off would-be conquerors ranging from Alexander the Great to 19th century Sikhs. For 900 years, part of the area was the independent kingdom of Hunza, if I'm saying that correctly. Tell me about that kingdom.
It was kind of a statelet, a mountain statelet, kind of a medieval, a feudal kingdom. And it was both a kind of a redoubt, a place that held off invaders, but also paradoxically a crossroads. So it is part of the Silk Road, and it exploited that. They were kind of the middlemen. It's where you changed your mule caravans, carrying silks and porcelain and or whatnot, going one direction or another. And they got rich off of this. And that attracted the attention of imperial powers, whether it was China or the British more recently. And they held out, Carolyn, until 1974.
So while you were walking in this area, you posted some amazing pictures of footbridges crossing rivers that cut through the mountains. They look a lot of fun and a little terrifying to walk across. Tell me about the people who use those every day, the people who live in this region.
Yeah, this is definitely not a place for agoraphobics. You know, if you do have trouble with heights, you might end up walking through this whole region looking up, not down. These footbridges, they span hundreds of yards across these chasms with roaring glacial rivers. And the people who use them are local pastoralists. They are still pushing yaks around over these snowfields. I met people who are carrying enormous loads of hay.
You filmed one couple that you met lifting these heavy loads of hay that you're talking about. Let's listen to that for a second. So what you could see if you were looking at this video is a man and a woman struggling to lift up these huge bundles of wild hay that look like they're about twice the size of their bodies onto their backs. They're kind of laying down onto the bundles and then rocking forward to stand up in a movement that looks like they've done it thousands of times. Tell me about this particular couple.
They were in their 70s, and these bundles, as you describe, are about the size of, like, industrial refrigerators. And I tried, Carolyn, to lift them. It's not in the video, but I said, hey, you know, I just been walking out of Africa, you know, like, you know, I've got lots of experience. Let me try switching my backpack for what you're carrying. I could not even get off the ground.
Wow.
It takes a certain kind of acrobatic balance to kind of rock yourself forward, rock yourself back in order to lift these things off the ground. And this elderly woman just, again, she put me in the shade.
One of the things that really struck me about what you wrote about this area is the local butter and how people store it for, what, decades for later use? Tell me how they do that.
Yes, you're talking about maltash, the famous maltash. Yeah, so you know, there's no refrigeration historically in this region, so people learn to bury their dairy products in the ground. And in this case, they buried it under the central square of this little village. Every family had kind of a flagstone, and underneath each flagstone in the central kind of square was a hole about 2 feet deep, in which there was a birch bark wrapped lump of butter that had been there anywhere from 10 years up to 50 years. And it was the way they preserved it. And the older the butter got, it was like wine, you know, the more flavorful it got. I tasted some. It basically tasted a bit like sour candles to me.
So did every family have like several packets of butter and they unearthed one just whenever they need more butter?
Exactly. It's like a communal refrigerator that you walk on top of. So, and you know, I said, how can you tell which is your flagstone? Because they're unmarked. Just imagine, Carolyn, these kind of like gray flagstones, they're odd shapes, rhomboid. And they said, they looked at me as if I was crazy. And it's like, how would you not know your own refrigerator?
So we've been talking about how some of these communities are still quite isolated, but I understand that the Karakoram Highway connects Western China with Islamabad, the Pakistani capital. It's bringing more tourists to this area, including those ancient villages that the road runs through. What has the impact been on people who live there?
Yeah, this highway has been there a while, but it's been expanded and widened by the Chinese. This highway project from Western China, it was one of the pioneering steps of China's Belt and Road Project. You may recall China about a decade ago launched this kind of massive, nearly global project to kind of build communications and trade corridors from China to other corners of the world. Well, it sort of was inaugurated in northern Pakistan. And what's happened, along with building, you know, improving some dams, you know, laying optic fiber cables and whatnot, improving a port, was the Karakoram Highway. And what used to take a long time to drive, now you can get up within a day of the capital, which has opened up this quite isolated corner of the Himalayas to more than 1.5 million tourists every year. And these communities are living kind of in a golden age of tourism, but it's also putting enormous strain on the local ecosystem in terms of trash, in terms of the trampling of very delicate high-altitude alpine wetlands. So I met one local administrator who was like at night Googling Nepal to try to figure out, looking at, you know, Nepal's problems to see how they can perhaps solve some similar ones with over-tourism in this region of northern Pakistan.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and National Geographic explorer Paul Solopek. He was talking about his project called the Out of Eden Walk. You can see his photographs, videos, and stories from Pakistan and many of the other places he's already visited. It's all at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org and our website, theworld.org. Thank you, as always, Paul.
Thank you, Carolyn. Always a pleasure to relive the walk.
Thank you for being with us today. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.